WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. During a stop in Arizona, Vice President Kamala Harris condemns the state's 160-year-old abortion ban and takes aim at former President Trump.
We all know if Donald Trump gets the chance, he will sign a national abortion ban. And how do we know? Just look at his record. Just look at the facts.
Trump at Mar-a-Lago today reiterated his position that a national abortion ban or limit is not necessary.
Because we broke Roe v. Wade and we did something that nobody thought was possible. We gave it back to the states, and the states are working very brilliantly, in some cases conservative, in some cases not conservative.
President Biden warns Iran could attack Israel soon, according to White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
We are making sure that we can protect ourselves and our facilities, as well as doing what we have to do to help Israel defend itself.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. 340 people in northwest Wisconsin will lose their jobs when window factory Jeld-Wen closes in Hawkins later this year. The company plans to move its Wisconsin production to its factory in central Illinois. The move will reportedly save the company at least $7 million. Wisconsin teachers are leaving the profession faster than ever. A new Department of Public Instruction report says 40% of new teachers leave teaching or leave Wisconsin after 6 years. And it's not just the low pay.
They're still being asked to take their work home with them, to work over the weekends. They're often being asked to teach both in person and virtually, sometimes simultaneously.
State School Superintendent Jill Underlie says Wisconsin has enough surplus money to fix the problem. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Eau Claire, 93.5 The Tap, and on the Civic Media app.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
93.5 The Tap.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I want to start off today with a conversation I had with someone who's much more optimistic than I am, believing that the 2024 election's already decided. It's in the bag. Biden's going to slide through. We're going to put down the MAGA hats, all of the Trumpism, all of the attacks on democracy, on women's rights, and very upbeat. I wish I could share that. And the argument, and look, I hope I'm wrong. And this is, again, one of those moments where hope I'm wrong. Don't know. But the argument was made that democracy was going to be what saved the day. That Americans believe in democracy. To their core, it's our fundamental value that we've internalized democracy. And I got to tell you, I wish I believed that. And as this person was telling me that this was the number one issue and that everyone cares about it, I tried to ask what they believed democracy was. And they just kept coming back to democracy. And I said, look, I sadly believe that there's a large number of people in this country who would be okay with an authoritarian figure, a dictator, if you will, as long as the trains ran on time, as long as they got what they needed, there was a roof over their head, food on the table, opportunities for their kids. If life didn't change enormously and they went after the right people, that democracy is, well, overrated for them. And the argument that I made was, look, the working class of this country is used to working and living in an authoritarian situation. They're used to a benevolent dictator. They go to work every day. They're told what to do, where to do it, how to do it. When they don't do it right, what happens to them? And they've been trained for decades to think that that's okay. That they really don't have a say in that workplace. That the boss is king, and they should follow along. And most people seem to be okay with that. I'm going to give up my free speech. I'm going to give up my liberty. I'm going to give up my economic freedom. I'm going to give up all this stuff as long as I get a paycheck. And that paycheck goes far enough to be able to keep a roof over my head, food on the table, and all that. And this person's like, well, no, I don't think that's... I'm going, no, I kind of do. I've done enough union organizing over the years to understand that we're willing to give up bits and pieces of our freedom and liberty for a little bit of security and safety. We're willing to give up our freedom to live in a neighborhood where, well, there are people like us. And, you know, I had it thrown at me as I was explaining to someone else. They said, it's kind of like the HOA lady is now running the country. Because, you know, you can move into one of these home ownership associations and, well, you can't paint the house any color you want. You can't put a flag out in front of your house if you don't want. And you've always got that one busybody neighbor who's ruining it for everybody. People are okay with that. And so for me, the idea of democracy is very high-minded. It's almost elitist to assume that everyone cares about democracy, when the reality is most people care about, are they going to be able to make it to tomorrow? Are they going to be able to put food on the table, roof over the head, clothes on the kids' back? If they get sick, are they going to go bankrupt? When they retire, are they going to live in a warehouse situation and die penniless with no one visiting them? I mean, this is the reality for working people. And to have the elites tell us, well, it's all about democracy. I'm a big fan of democracy. I think we should do more democratic things, you know, kind of with our economy, too. You know, when you start talking about capitalism and, you know, democracy in the same breath, it's kind of hard. So for me, I've got to this point to where I think that, you know, this argument that it's going to be all about democracy, I think it's going to be partially some people, me, for instance. But for a large number of people, I don't know. And that's why I'm curious. Is democracy part of something that's important to you? Is this the hill we die on, or is giving shades of it away, you know, just the cost of doing business? I look at right now, you've got Republicans on the House of Representatives floor making speeches that could come right out of the Russian propaganda machine. You had Tucker Carlson shopping in Russia, doing his shopping, saying how wonderful it is. Look, they have food. Look, they have stuff. Oh, look, you can put this coin in the cart. Oh, isn't that cute? Basically normalizing a Putin-esque kind of authoritarian world. And I believe, sadly, to my core, that there are a large number of people in this country, generally the ones wearing a red hat. And fortunately, they tell us who they are, who would be okay with that. As long as it's their strongman, as long as it's the Trumpians, as long as it's the God-fearing Christian folk, until they come for them, of course. And this abortion issue is part of that. Until they come for you. You know, when it's just about making those women, those poor women, have children, and they start saying, well, no, you wealthier women who can afford in virtual fertilization, no, we're coming for you too. That changes the calculus a bit. So for me, do you think as a country, democracy matters? Do you think it's that hill that working people are willing to die on? Or do you think it's something that we've been told so often throughout our lifetime that it's who we are, that we've kind of taken it for granted without actually understanding what it is that we have and what it is that we're willing to potentially give away? Because I argue our generation right now, not really sure what it took to fight, bleed, and die for all of the things we've taken for granted. And we're willing to trade it away. Could democracy, Could democracy be that next thing we're willing to trade away? And this election really truly is about, do you believe in democracy or don't you? I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing, do Americans really, really care? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, abortion in Arizona, front and center. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm looking at Arizona, and their state Supreme Court, you know, recently reinstated a ban on abortion that dates back to 1864. And you go, 1864, was Arizona even a state then? And the answer, no. They weren't officially admitted into the Union until Valentine's Day, 1912. Now, I'm sure back in 1912, Valentine's Day, I don't know if it was a thing. But on February 14th, 1912, that's when the state of Arizona became the state of Arizona, which is weird to me that you would choose an 1864 law to uphold your assault on women's rights all these years later. But hey, when you've got an agenda, sanity, reality, legal precedents, decided law, none of that matters. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on in Arizona, I've asked Cameron Stevens to come talk with us. He's the founding editor and chief political correspondent over at the Copper Courier. They're part of Courier Newsroom. They have been covering this extensively for the last, well, since the dog caught the car. And, you know, the Supreme Court surprised even Republicans by overturning Roe. Cameron, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. And thanks for bringing up this topic. It's really important that people know what's going on here.
No, anytime someone gets their rights taken from them, even if I'm not on your side, I'm going, you know, that's not what this country's about. It's about expanding opportunities, expanding rights. And look, as I've said a million times in this program, I've got daughters. I want them to be safe. So to have religious zealots telling my daughters how they're going to have to live their lives, I have a problem with that. And let's look at Arizona, this 1864 law. How do you justify going back to where before you weren't even a state and going, this is it?
Well, it's a long process of Republican legislators wanting to make sure that that ban, which is probably one of the most cruel abortion bans in the country, becomes law here. Even when, you know, when Roe was when Roe was decided in the 70s, up until it was overturned a couple of years ago, Republicans here in our state legislature were passing all sorts of mini bans or would be bans or this ban will go into effect if this happens sort of thing. But they always made sure to add in there that if Roe were to be overturned, the original 1864 ban would be the one that goes into effect. And so they sort of paved the way, and anyone who really understood what the law was kind of knew what the state Supreme Court was going to rule. But it doesn't make it any more of a shock when it happened.
So as an outsider then, what you're saying is, as an outsider, I shouldn't be surprised that Republicans pay really smart people to think up really bad ideas and to think into the future so that they can preempt anything that comes down the road, this being part of that.
Yes. Yeah. Everything they've done as far as reproductive rights and that type of legislation has all been to chip away at the old protections and make sure that the even older restrictions and punishments would come back once those protections were gone.
Now, you've been covering this a long time, you know, since, like I said, the dog caught the car. What has surprised me, Cameron, and I'll be honest, I thought the Christian version of the GOP, I thought the family values crowd would have, once Roe became no longer the law of the land, that they would at least do some kind of, I don't know, some kind of show that they really do care about the children, that they would have maybe, you know, some kind of a tax credit, some kind of a school lunch program, I don't know, you know, free cheese on Fridays, you know, something to say, hey, we do care about the children, so we're going to, yeah, you're going to have them, but there's going to be something, you know, a sticker, you know, that, hey, I had a child, I don't know, something. But there hasn't been anything from the right to want people, to help people want to have kids, as opposed to, you know, just going to force this on you. Or am I the only one who sees that?
No, it's, I mean, it definitely doesn't go unnoticed here. That has been brought up even, you know, by children's advocacy groups and organizations, that we need to have more protections and more safety nets for young families, you know, struggling working class families who don't have the funds to necessarily provide in the best way possible for their kids. We're not seeing that type of legislation even being allowed to be introduced here. You know, Democratic representatives have brought legislation to, you know, increase unemployment insurance, for example, because Arizona has some of the lowest paying social safety nets in the country. They've introduced things for free lunch, reduced lunch, you know, alternative transportation options so kids can get to school, and they don't even get a hearing in our state legislature because apparently, as far as they're concerned, as soon as the child is born is when they are uncared for.
And no, but the reason I bring this up is, and I want to get into all of the court stuff and all that stuff, but the, you know, whenever I talk about this issue, you know, as someone who grew up in a housing project and remembers what it was like not to have food at the end of the month, remembers what it was like to live in a community where violence was ruled the day and there were no jobs and we weren't on the bus line, I look at that and go, you know, how do we help that kid growing up in that housing project that I grew up and have a better life than I had and had better opportunities than I had. And none of that stuff is allowed to even be discussed because all the oxygen is, well, we're just going to force women to have children. And the weird thing is I've been saying for decades that, you know, the conservative movement wants women back in the kitchen, gays back in the closets, and minorities back in the field and nothing else. And they seem to be trying to live up to that.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, to some extent, they're not even trying to hide that anymore. We hear those sort of things at our state legislature all the time, where they don't understand, you know, why women should be working, why, you know, there should be these dual incomes, why kids should even be in school. You know, we have a pretty extensive universal voucher program that essentially has the government pay people to homeschool their kids, generally catering towards, you know, far right Christian ideology. And so it's not even something that is pretended to not be the case. I feel like we've gotten to the point where they're proudly saying, we want these people to be working here. We want this gender to be in this place. And we want the white males of the world to be on top because that's who is making the laws and they want what's best for them.
Now, here's the thing, you know, as an old white male, you know, as a landowning white male over 21, there's part of me that goes, I could live in that world. But I go back to, again, I've got two daughters that I don't want them to live in that world because I know what that looks like. We've seen it. It ain't great. So, you know, this should be, since women seem to be the majority of the population, this should be a political no brainer that these people get washed aside. How is this even still an issue in the voting world when you would think women would like, what? You're taking my rights away? No.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's the surprising thing that people who are anti-abortion are seeing, is that people, women, men, supporters, allies, they're all standing up to these laws and saying, no, we don't want this. This doesn't represent the people. This isn't about what equality and progressive, you know, building a more equitable America is all about. That's why here, you know, we have, as we've seen in a lot of other states, a ballot proposition to protect reproductive rights in the state's constitution. And this ballot proposition is so popular that, you know, 3 months before the signatures are due to get it on the ballot, it's already collected 500,000 voter signatures, which is more than any other citizens initiative in the history of our state.
So I've got Democratic strategist friends who think that this issue is going to help the Democrats in November. Do you think this helps maybe, you know, not have one of the craziest people in the Senate win in your state, the Carrie Lake? Do you think this helps maybe move Arizona in the blue direction? Does this move that?
Yeah, you know, I'll preface this by saying that I would rather have a more uphill battle to a more pro-democracy representation here as Arizona than stripping away the rights of women for, you know, however long this ban lasts. But that being said, this ban, yes, it energizes people who are independent, people who are conservative but pro-abortion or pro-choice. It leads them to not only want to make sure they fill out their ballots and vote in favor of this proposition, but the easiest, you know, single vote issue on that ballot is, does this person support reproductive rights or not? And in the case of, you know, Carrie Lake, for example, I think it's pretty clear from her history that she does not.
Yeah, and it's even further than just the right to an abortion or not. Now we see coming out of Alabama the in vitro fertilization issue that has now come boiled to the top, to where even you've got Republicans who have been against this before now having, you know, in a weird position, because now the public's like going, well, what's wrong with that? This, again, the, you know, the unintended consequences of the dog catching the car.
Yeah, and to be honest, this abortion ban, it got rid of our protections for fertility care like IVF. And so just like Alabama, fertility clinics in Arizona are now opened up to wrongful death lawsuits. It could happen. It could only be a matter of time before we see the exact same situation here.
Wow. So let's go back to this 1864 abortion ban. You said a moment ago it's the one of the worst in the country. What makes it so?
Well, one, the fact that it was written in the 19th century says a lot about its adherence to modern medicine and women in general. You know, back then women were borderline property, and if you got sick, you would chop off a limb or toss some leeches on yourself to make sure you were okay. That's not really the case anymore. We've advanced a lot. This ban doesn't really allow any exceptions. It doesn't allow someone who's a victim of sexual assault, who's been raped or has been otherwise assaulted, to have a medical procedure so that they don't have to carry that pregnancy to term. It also has very, very punitive damages. Anyone who assists in helping someone to obtain an abortion, whether it be a doctor or someone driving them to the hospital or someone providing information, they can be charged and convicted of breaking this law. And the minimum sentence for that is 2 years in prison.
Wow. And now does this, you know, I've seen places like Texas who wants to follow you across state lines. Does this follow across state lines?
Some would argue that Texas's doesn't either, but ours also does not. It's strictly in Arizona. And the benefit we have over Texas is that we have a Democratic attorney general who has said she will not prosecute this law in any sense. And our also Democratic governor, she issued an executive order consolidating all power over abortion-related laws to the attorney general. So, you know, even our most conservative anti-abortion county prosecutor can't prosecute this law. Now, that's all until, you know, if we got a different attorney general, it's a different story. But for now, this law will not be prosecuted.
Yeah, I mean, I just look at this and I go, you know, the direction we're heading, if something like this is allowed to stand, only gets worse. And I said, you know, at the beginning, you know, when I started doing this program almost 20 years ago, I said, look, Roe is on the chopping blocks. They desperately want to overturn it. And then once that happens, and I've been saying this for almost 20 years, there will be a domino effect. You know, once Roe goes, then goes Griswold, then goes Obergefell, then goes all of the Loving and all of the things, well, the 20th century. We end up and back in the 1860s looking towards how things used to be.
Yeah, it's one thing that this we are at this point, and I hope that to an extent it is a wake-up call for people to recognize what power they have to actually exhibit control in their government. You know, we are seeing that in states where these ballot propositions are being passed. If other laws that put, you know, same-sex marriage at risk or interracial marriage at risk, I am optimistic in hoping that it would only build that power and momentum against those terrible, like, retroactive decisions, should they come to pass.
Yeah, I was looking at one of the pieces that you had written about some Arizona Republicans who are running away from the abortion law that they want. This is something that I think, you know, politically, the Democrats on every level have to be hammering on time and time again. On the presidential level, you know, Trump did this. Trump wanted it. Trump did it. Trump got it done. Hang it around his neck. And at every level of people who voted for this kind of stuff, because I think this should be one of those defining votes to where we start throwing some bums out.
Yeah, and I think it is. And we are seeing that. Like you said, there are several Republicans in the legislature who voted for the ban in 2022, which, again, allowed for the 1864 ban to take effect, who are now saying, no, we don't want this total ban. We only want the 15 weeks, which is still very extreme, still doesn't take care of a lot of people's healthcare needs. But they're being almost immediately called out by it.
Yeah.
There's one Republican legislator here, Matt Gress, who he introduced 5 fetal personhood bills last year. And what that does is it declares from the point of conception, it says that zygote or that embryo or fetus is as much of a human life as an independently living adult person. Which would, you know, not only ban abortions outright, but it would also make IVF at risk for wrongful death lawsuits.
Now, do we count them in the census so we can get them proportional representation in Congress? I mean, is that what we're going to do? Do we get to write them off on our taxes?
You know, it might be one state at a time, but I maybe that's what we're working to.
Do I get to write them off on my taxes?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's funny you should say that because one of the laws he did, because they weren't outright, you know, he didn't write a law that said fetuses are persons, are people, because that would just be, you know, that's kind of absurd. And so he did things like he wrote a law saying, or a bill saying that a pregnant woman could drive in the HOV lane because she's pregnant, which, you know, by extension is the law then admitting that her whatever's in her uterus is a living person enough to necessitate driving in the carpool lane.
You know, I'm waiting for the Monty Python bill, you know, the every sperm is sacred bill. And that would get the attention of every teenage boy in the country. You know, ultimately, because sadly, and then you laugh, but sadly, I think there are those who it could go this far. And if you allow the zealot class to rule on this, and as I said from the beginning, I'm not personally a someone who's in favor of abortion. I am pro-safety. I want no woman to die in an alley or of an infection because of a backroom abortion in this country ever. Not my daughters, not your daughters, not even Donald Trump's daughters. That said, I'm still on the pro-safety bandwagon, which means I want to make sure that things are safe and legal, but I would prefer them being rare. But it's not my choice. And this is where the people who tell us they want government out of our lives and smaller, less intrusive government, being the ones driving this stuff, that's what drives me insane, because they're hypocrites.
Yeah, the very idea of saying that we don't want the government involved in our lives except when it's the things that we want to make sure everyone does no matter what, It's just the definition of hypocrisy. Yep. And that's, again, that's why we're seeing Republicans at the state legislature and in our congressional representation. They are, you know, trying to sidestep this total ban while still very much supporting it behind closed doors.
Going to be interesting to see what comes out in November as we go to the polls. I hope folks will check out your website there at the Copper Courier. We'll get links out on social media, how you can do that. Also, Courier Newsroom. Cameron, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great stuff. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
Cameron Stevenson, founder, editor, and chief political correspondent there at the Copper Courier. Want to hear your thoughts. You know, two white guys talking about abortion. Is it our lane? Is this something we should be focusing on? Is this solely the world of women? Or do we all have a say in it? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, to a low in the mid-30s. Mostly sunny, breezy, and warmer for tomorrow, high in the mid-70s. And more sunshine for Sunday, high, low 70s. On Monday, sun continues and breezy again, back to the mid-70s. Showers and storms likely Tuesday. Right now it's 48.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Todd and his regular guest Trigvi Olsen were out and about with a simple theme. What makes Wisconsin great? For all the divisive topics and politics that we have on his show and on my show, we're doing that because we love living here and we want to talk about the things that make Wisconsin great. And we did that over cheese curds and cold beer last night. Ooh. And I really appreciate Todd doing that.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, wow, what's going on in the Buckeye State? Every time I turn around, more Republicans indicted, accused, or, well, worse. Sounds like, you know, Ohio's turned into one of those true crime podcasts. Because I was thinking about it today. I was like, you know, there are more coming out around this House Bill 6. You got the former speaker in a whole bunch of trouble. You got the guy, I think, down in Florida who killed himself wearing a DeWine T-shirt. And in the latest episode of True Crime Ohio, 74-year-old Sam Randazzo, former chairman of the Ohio Public Utilities Commission, facing numerous charges on the state and federal levels for allegedly taking bribes from First Energy, reportedly committed suicide by hanging himself from the rafters of a warehouse that he owned. Suicide? Or is there more? And here to share some thoughts on the latest episode of True Crime Ohio, I've asked David Pepper to come talk with us. David's the former chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, also author of Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. You know, I've written political thrillers, but none of them have been as crazy as what you just described. It really has been this wild a number of years here where it's just corruption uninterrupted.
And it really shows that, you know, absolute power corrupts. Absolutely.
It does. It also shows that it starts at the top. I mean, the powers that be want this to seem like, you know, one state rep or one moment. It goes year after year after year. 6 years ago, like the fourth speaker ago resigned, like 2 days ago in 6 years. Because of an FBI investigation into pay-to-play with payday lending. We're on our third or fourth speaker since. I mean, it never ends. And what's incredible is, and this just shows you sort of that they view this as business as usual. In all these years, none of them ever proposes any kind of reform to clean it up. Nothing.
It's just nothing. The cost of doing business. Well, one guy hangs.
It's how they think it's supposed to go. And they'll sort of in their mind and think, well, he did that. Well, we didn't do that. Well, once it's true pay to play, which is what it is, you know, and once that's the culture, you're going to keep doing it until you just throw all these guys out. It's all they've ever known.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
but I will say with the second suicide in a couple of years is this week indictments, it's clearly at a peak, right? I mean, it's more insane than ever.
Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine who lives in Ohio, you know, pointed this out. I go, you know, has Harry Caray come to Ohio? Is this where finally, you know, these criminals are going, you know, I got to do the honorable thing and just be done with it. I don't think so, but, you know, it appears.
Yeah, I think a lot of these politicians, all they've ever known is a pay-to-play culture. And so in a way they thought, well, as long as I don't take a personal bribe, I'm not doing anything wrong. And my philosophy is, no, if you're giving, and this is what happened in the Ohio First Energy case, the lieutenant governor came out earlier this week, had a super PAC dedicated to his victory that First Energy gave $1 million to. And then the governor had tons of First Energy money go to, I think, the Republican Governor Association. They knew that. And before they were ever sworn in as governor, lieutenant governor, they had a private meeting with the head of First Energy at a athletic club in Columbus, where he basically was saying, this is the person who I want to regulate us, the person you mentioned. And they said, okay. So we literally have a million plus flowing to the collective of these two. They're not even sworn in yet. And they're letting the subject of the regulation handpick the regulator. Now, that's the problem. And even if they didn't get the personal bribe for the Florida House rehab, but my argument is it's the giving away of public power and public assets to the private interests when they ask you, when they've given you all that money. That's the deeper corruption of public service in states like Ohio in such a downward spiral. And that act of putting the guy in charge of regulating the company, having it be the handpicked selection of that company, everything that's come since, the bad legislation, the $1 billion giveaway, all of it, that all stemmed from that initial decision to put, you know, the fox in charge of the hen house. Because the fox told you to.
Yeah.
And that was a decision made by the governor and the lieutenant governor of the state of Ohio, who still today are talking as if we weren't part of this. We didn't do anything wrong when they made the initial decision I just described in the first place that everything flowed from.
Yeah, but here's the thing, David. You know, Ohio's been corrupt, I don't know, for a while. I remember years ago something about coins and workers' comp, or was it unemployment? I don't even remember what the scandal was, but... But a time and time again,
a for-profit scam school that took money right out of the hands of public schools and stuck it to a for-profit scam that wasn't even taking attendance for the students they claimed. Yeah, it does just keep going. And I think, frankly, that's a challenge to Democrats who clearly, except for one moment in 06, have not been able to make the case that we can do better, because we obviously can do better than this.
Yeah, at least I would hope so. I mean, at the end of the day, when every year there seems to be a new scandal, a new person going to jail, and now you've got two people who have killed themselves, or maybe, you know, the person I was talking to goes, I don't know, maybe the guy hung himself, maybe he didn't. You know, maybe this is, you know, again, back to the true crime podcast thing, because this is almost unbelievable to hear all of these things that keep coming out. And it makes me wonder, when do voters go, you know, maybe all of them got to go?
Yeah, I mean, my attitude, and I wrote something on this last week, the thing that we all have to do, and it's not just Democrats, it's anyone who's tired of this corruption, the secret of the pay-to-play corruption that we have in Ohio, this is true in other states, it's not that some fat cat is bribing the official or doing pay-to-play with that fat cat's money. They're doing it with your money. What they've done is they get themselves in a position like the for-profit school operator. The money he's given to the politicians to keep the scam going isn't his money. He started out with very little. It's our money.
Yeah.
It's our public dollars. Just like I go into this thing I wrote a couple of days ago, a massive amount of money that goes to the Republican Party of Ohio and the Attorney General of Ohio is coming from the debt collection paid by student debtors and medical debt payers who are in collections. It's a whole racket that the collections companies are picked by the attorney general. they make a cut from their collections, and they give a cut of their cut to the politicians and the parties. So people who are struggling to pay their student debt or their medical debt are literally among together the largest donors to Republican politicians in the state of Ohio. And so we have to, I think, be much more clear that this isn't some millionaire paying for the corruption. It's coming out of your rates, your energy bill. It's coming out of your student debt. It's coming out of the dollars you thought were for schools. And it's being used to enrich private folks and not to do the things that you think are supposed to be done with your money. At some point, you'd hope that if somehow you connected it clearly, that you would have a grassroots uprising that says, why is my public dollar from a small county in Ohio going to pay for some scam in Columbus for someone to become a millionaire and he gives a cut of it back to the politicians in Columbus? At some point, you think that would happen. Clearly, in the last couple of years, although we've had endless rounds of this, it hasn't broken through yet. It does need to, though. It's really, for those of us who care about Ohio and think Ohio's better than this, it's obviously been just a nonstop frustrating downward spiral.
No, and this is the perfect issue. Especially because your rates just went up fairly high, if I'm not mistaken, because I have a relative who was complaining that their rates skyrocketed this year. This is something that, along with inflation, this is something you go, look, this is what's happened to you, and this is why. So it seems like you could draw that direct line.
Totally. I mean, I think that's, to me, it's there's some leading issues that you could make people understand that it's they're paying for it, because that's not how it's framed. It's you see the CEO in trouble and you think, well, he did it wrong. He must have given a bribe to the politician. But no, you're the one, your money is the thing that is turned into the pay to play. And you're paying more because of it. Rates went up. There's actually a one office called the Consumer Counsel Office, to their credit. It's a public office. It's supposed to be sort of a rate payer, a watchdog. They have on their website a ticker every single day of the amount of money we are all paying for this corrupt bill. And it's, you know, hundreds of thousands every single day, millions and millions, including a bailout of a plant in Indiana, even though we're all in Ohio. So, but in the end, I think we have to do a better job of showing everyday people who basically come to believe that corruption's throughout politics. And that's the other thing. It's been normalized.
Yeah.
They just think that's got to be what it is no matter what. And it's, at some point, it's kind of hard to blame them for thinking that. I think we have to do a much better job of saying, no, there's a way to run government without corruption. First and foremost, you'll get better results. And secondly, you're paying for all the corruption. Your dollars are paying for it. And the other thing I think we have to connect is, and the outcomes for your community are suffering because of it. Every dollar that for-profit school scam took to make that guy a millionaire came out of public schools. And so if you're paying more for public schools or sports or higher property taxes, or you only have 4 days of school a week because there's not enough funding, that's directly correlated to the corruption. We have to make that connection far more clearly than I think people see it right now.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, on the school voucher thing and the charter schools and all that, at least in my state of Pennsylvania, some Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans on this, in giving money to these for-profit charters and these bad, in my view, bad actors. So, you know, how do you deal with that? Because then it plays back into, well, it's both sides. Because you get that a lot, yeah. The both sides isms. You know, it's both sides. There are no champions, no heroes here.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, and if I am up to my ears livid on this universal voucher explosion. We are now seeing in state after state, and this is the same kind of give public goods to private players. You know, they're finding in these, it used to be the narrative, and this maybe is when some Democrats voted for it, that vouchers were to help poor kids in urban areas and struggling schools have a choice to go to a better school. Well, at some point in Ohio, there were some restrictions that made it look like that was the goal. Well, in all across the country, they've gotten rid of the restrictions. So we now know in the last couple of years in states like Ohio, in Missouri, in Arizona, in Florida, almost all the money is literally going to pay for kids who were already in private school who could already afford that private school. It's an absolute runaway subsidy for frankly, upper middle class families to pay for the decision they already made years ago.
Yep.
And by the way, it's polling money out of the same budgets that are supposed to be supporting public schools. And in many areas, it's like a rural versus more suburban thing. The rural communities don't even have those schools. So it's coming right out of your broader public school, including that rural school that's the only school in that rural county, to help basically people in well-off suburbs pay for the education they were already getting in a private school. It's absolutely runaway freight train. You know, Arkansas has done this under Huckabee Sanders. In her first year, 95% of those vouchers went to kids who had already been at private school and could afford it. So it's just one other example where the people in these state houses, and I'm not accusing anyone of bribery here, but it's the broader corruption of public service. They are no longer there to serve the public. They are using public power and public assets to support the private interests to keep them in power. And by the way, in this case, they get a lot of money from DeVos and others for doing it. And if they stand up against it like they did in Texas recently, DeVos will come in and spend tons against them in a primary to get a pro-voucher person in. A couple of the people who'd stood up to Abbott in Texas, Republicans, literally lost because of big-time billionaire money against them. So, yeah, the universal voucher has become, to me, almost a symbol of the corruption of what used to be public service into people literally working night and day to move public money to private interests like private schools.
But isn't this the argument of privatization as a whole, no matter what it is, of the things that, you know, my grandparents' generation thought of as the commons, whether it's parking, whether it's, you know, your turnpikes, whether it's education, whether it's public utilities, things that we used to regulate and own as part of, you know, just being part of society, that we sold off under the guise of, well, the private interests can do it better, faster, cheaper, right, only to find out, no, they can't. It's actually worse. It's actually more expensive. And actually, we get back a whole bunch of problems. But someone gets rich. Yeah. Isn't this part of all that?
It is. And in some ways, it's sort of like once you're willing to do it to the what was, and I think still is for most people, a universal belief in the value of public education, that this was not some pure market thing like they've tried to convince people on other public service. So my view is, if you're willing to sell your kids out and public education out to the highest bidder, which is what they've done in states like Ohio, that's it. You'll sell anything out. So the idea that they've taken that broader philosophy, which used to maybe be for how do you purchase things or what services, the fact that they are applying it right now, and it's exploding in the last 2 years, the year 22 and 23 have seen an explosion of universal vouchers. They are going for broke right now. As we watch Trump and the national stuff, in these states, they are going for broke on universal vouchers. And it's hardly breaking through with national coverage. And I think they're doing this partly because they know, although the numbers are terrible, it's mainly going to subsidize kids who are in private schools. My great fear is they know that once it settles in, that this is the budget of most families doing these schools, you can't take it away. It'll be a genie out of the bottle. The schools are now raising their tuition to account for it. The families, as part of their annual budget, they're rushing it through. So in a couple of years, people are so used to it, you can't take it back. But if you're willing to do that for education, basically means you'll do it for anything. Yep. And that's really where we are right now.
No, but this
I mean, in fact, the Democrats, I want to see Democrats, including in Congress, including the president, speak out. This is where the fact that we don't pay enough attention to red states really hurts us, that this is exploding in a way that I don't know if we'll be able to get it back. And in Washington, you kind of don't even hear about it. And in a couple years, it's going to be out the door. So I do think we need to hear more from Democrats all over, like a loud opposition to this, much louder than we've seen up till now.
Well, what I've been saying is, look, you know, exactly what you've said. They're working to privatize education, profitize, and line their pockets. All the while, what they're doing is they're gutting child labor laws so that when kids can't afford to go to these private schools or there's nothing left of the public schools, we can get them to work at a young age because they got small hands. They can do intricate work. And they have a longer career, you know, might help them, you know, save a little bit more for retirement, because it just seems like they're going hand in hand.
They are. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you're seeing that in multiple ways. You're seeing the, you know, and again, I'm all for people choosing the career path. And if they find something they want early on, they can get the skills. great, but there's also a value to a broader education.
Yeah, you're never getting me, David, to say it's okay for someone to get to eighth grade and drop out of school and go work on an industrial farm in Indiana. That is I'm never going there.
Yeah, we want citizens. We want citizens with a broad education, and I do think that the direction that you're talking about is, when you see sort of the reduction in the child labor protections, and you see this, and then you see this, you know, we saw in Ohio, Betsy DeVos, when she was Secretary of Education, was all about combining education and workforce into one department. That was sort of a big push to kind of do what you're saying. Well, that's what they did in Ohio already. So I do think the more you mash that together, although it sounds logical at a certain level, yeah, that's the risk. And what's happening on these private schools, back to the broader point, we already are seeing, one, the private schools are pushing the families to take the voucher. We've had letters sent we've seen them in Ohio basically say, if you don't take this voucher, you're going to have a meeting with us, or other aid you've gotten will disappear. So there's a lot of pressure. There's advertising, take it. And what's happening at the same exact time? A lot of these schools are raising tuition because they got a guaranteed $7K or $8K a student. So it's not as if it's providing opportunity. It's basically making it more inaccessible. And so the only people who are going to take the voucher are the ones who basically can already pay a certain pretty high amount, and the voucher gets them the rest of the way to that even higher tuition. It's not helping the people at the lowest end make the – so it counters the false sales pitch. This is about helping those who have little get this option. Oh, by the way, one other thing too, going back to the profit making. Of the very few – percentage these days who are using the voucher to go from a public school to a private school, the scores in Ohio at least already show a dramatic decline in their scores, because a lot of these schools they're going to are less regulated. They don't have to meet a lot of the standards. And long term, what's going to happen, as you've described, this is going to turn into a profit-making opportunity for a bunch of low-flying, low-quality schools that see this money through the vouchers as profits for them. And so what we're actually subsidizing, in addition to private school folks still going to the private school they always went to, you're also going to see subsidizing of people, as is already happening, leaving a public school to go to a worse private school and get worse results. So it's really, honestly, this is why you can hear me get worked up about this. It's all leaving the barn right now in states like Ohio.
Yeah.
And we don't have that much time to get the word out to stop it. Here's the interesting thing. No public referendum to go for universal vouchers has ever passed. People actually don't like it. And so we have to do a better job of explaining that you don't like it, but it's happening right now. It's going to undermine public education. And I think at the state level, school board level, but also the federal level, I think we all need to really make a lot more noise about it. I'm trying to do that as best I can here in Ohio.
Yeah, I'm with you, and you're doing a great job. Keep it up. I hope you'll come back and share more with us as the True Crime Podcast Ohio continues, because I don't see any good coming anytime soon. So I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about. David, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Take care.
David Pepper, former chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party. I want to hear your thoughts. The voucher thing, something you're on board in? I go back to, you know, the state senator I knew told me if I got this golden ticket, I could send my kid anywhere and it would cover all the costs. It was universal. It was beautiful. Only to find out, not so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that workers at the Toledo Auto Light Factory decided to go on strike. The company made electric starters for the auto giants in nearby Detroit. The punishing effects of the Great Depression had hit the auto industry hard. Unemployment in the industrial city of Toledo soared. At the auto light plant, workers faced increased scrutiny from their bosses, who knew hundreds of eager-to-work laborers stood at the ready just outside the plant's gate, ready to take the job of anyone who dared to complain. Philip Croth and Margaret Beagle recalled the working conditions in an oral history of the strike, saying, "Under observation, even into the toilets, workers found themselves sneaking a bite to eat or a puff of a cigarette, a aware that they would be fired if discovered. One of the most hated practices by management was known as the bench. Workers were told to sit on a bench where they would wait until they were needed to perform a job. Once that job ended, they went back to the bench, being paid for only the time spent while working. Faced with such conditions, the workers had had enough and went out on strike. The company won an injunction that allowed only 25 workers to picket at any one location. But then something happened that the company had not expected. The Lucas County Unemployment League stood up with the picketers. Instead of taking the jobs of those on strike, the unemployed members of the league rallied to the picket lines in defiance of the injunction. In late May, picketers and the National Guard clashed in what became known as the Battle of Toledo. Finally, on June 2nd, the strike was settled. The workers had won a 5% raise and union recognition. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I got to tell you, David Pepper is not wrong when it comes to public education. If they are able to destroy public education, privatize, profitize, put it in the hands of the DeVoses and the Jeffrey Yazes of the world, you know, the big moneyed people who think they know better than, well, all of us, we're in trouble. And this is politically, I've been saying for a very long time, for Democrats, an issue that they should get on board with. And yes, I know there are some Democrats in big cities where public schools have been struggling because the funding hasn't been there, saying, hey, this is the next silver bullet that might solve our problems, might get us some campaign cash. Because again, it's all about the campaign cash. It's all about the money that they're able to get from, not from millionaires and billionaires, but from the tax base. I've been saying for a long time, when Wall Street gets their hands on Education Incorporated and they can get their hands into the tax till, oh boy, we'll spend money on education. We won't get the education, but we'll spend money on it. And this is where having two systems, bad idea. And why this is a huge winner in rural America. The reality is every dollar that isn't spent on public education in rural America is going somewhere else because there isn't enough. There isn't enough demand. There aren't enough kids to go off into all of these separate schools that they're trying to create. But what it does do masterfully is it sucks little bits of money out of the public school, which then starts to mean less programs. Maybe we don't have shop class, or maybe we don't have a bigger shop class, or maybe we don't have extracurriculars anymore. Maybe we don't have sports programs. Maybe in order to participate in these, you got to start paying for them. You know, when I was in school, whatever extracurricular you wanted to do, it was there for you. There was no digging deep into mom and dad's pocket and going, hey, I can afford to do this. But my daughter wanted to play drums. She wanted to do the drum thing. Where they do these big displays, and they're fantastic. It's an amazing opportunity for kids to participate, to learn teamwork, to learn an instrument, all just great stuff. But if you can't cough up the $250, I don't know, you don't get to play. And is that the direction we want to be? The answer is no. So for me, the idea that we're going to destroy your local rural public schools, this should be a winner for Democrats in rural America. And the sad reality is, I don't know that we're even making that outreach. And I look at Kansas, where Brownback destroyed public education. I look at Iowa, where right now you've got the Republicans who control all levers of power, destroying what was one of the top education systems in the country. Now, will this turn around and bite them in Iowa? I kind of hope so. But at what cost? At what cost to the kids who aren't going to get the quality education that they should have gotten from the beginning? Because every time there's an ad on the local radio, every time a corporation figures out how to get a contract that they can then profit from, every time there's this newfangled gimmick that we divert money from public education into these, well, gimmicks, what happens to our kids? What opportunities do they lose? I look at myself. I went to a middle class high school. They had all of the programs you could have wanted. Shop class was incredible. Learned a lot. Personally, did not take advantage of it as I should have, and I'll be the first to admit that. But it was there. Now, not so much. I want to hear your thoughts. What's it look like in your neighborhood? If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. I want to hear it. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'll miss any portion of the video, freespeech.org. That's where you catch our videos. Thanks so much for being here. Smith Show.
Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to...
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic